Blog Talk Radio.
Are you trying to lose weight, find love, or build a successful business? Whatever goal you're trying to achieve, the most important key is learning how not to sabotage your own best efforts. Today's speaker will help us to plumb the depths of our minds to stop this debilitating self-sabotage. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, spiritual relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the book Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, and the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of Healing Through Love seminars and the 30 Love Lessons for Your Soul, and a special upcoming Men in Love series of virtual events. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. And our mindset has a lot to do with it. Dr. Eldon Taylor is a mind power expert and a New York Times best-selling author. He has written 14 books and created over 300 audio and video personal motivation programs. His other best-selling books include I Believe, When What You Believe Matters, Mind Programming, From Persuasion and Brainwashing to Self-Help and Practical Metaphysics, What Does That Mean, Exploring Mind, Meaning, and Mysteries, and What If, The Challenge of Self-Realization. Dr. Eldon is also the host of the popular radio show Provocative Enlightenment, the inventor of the patented and scientifically proven Inner Talk technology, and founder of Progressive Awareness Research Incorporated. He has appeared in numerous films, television, and radio shows, is a regular guest on Coast to Coast AM with George Noory, and lectures around the world. And you can find him on his website, eldontaylor.com, and at provocativeenlightenment.com. So it is great pleasure for me to welcome you, Dr. Eldon Taylor.
It's indeed my pleasure to join you, Dr. Goodstone. I'm looking forward to this, and I love your Kindle series. You've got a great series of books that you didn't mention, including one that I really like, Be Who You Are.
Oh, thank you so much. Right. I always feel like I'm saying too much about myself. So anyway, I'd love to hear about your background, your education and training. What led you to become a mind power expert? And also explain what that is.
Well, you know, that'll take us more than a day. But let me see if I can boil it down. I don't know. You know, I do believe, as you suggest in your own work, Be Who You Are, that, you know, we have unique talents and abilities, and they express themselves early in our lives. And unfortunately, very often, we push them aside. We choose to become inauthentic in our process of enculturation. But for me, when I was, you know, it all started, I should say, when I was a very young man. I guess I was, you know, seven or so. And my neighbor lady came over, And she was having a discussion with my mother that I could hear. I was in the living room. They were in kind of the little dining area, coffee klatch area. And she was telling my mother all about why her husband was a no-good, worthless son of a gun, and they were getting a divorce. But as she was talking, I knew she was lying. Now, I can't tell you how I knew she was lying. I just knew she was lying. And like a child that doesn't know a lot better, I just said, "You're not telling my mother the truth." I got in a great deal of trouble over that, but it turned out that, you know, later we learned she wasn't. I was right. Well, for whatever reason, from that period forward, I became really alert and keen to signals people give off, how their voice is delivered and their mannerisms and their rate of speech. And then, you know, of course, you discover things like neuro-linguistic programming and hypnosis. And the next thing I knew, I'm an adult, and my day consists of lie detection examinations. So for a number of years, I conducted lie detection examinations, forensic hypnosis, investigations, interrogations, and I would continually hear people say things, give me reasons for why they did what they did that, you know, that in any rational sense didn't make sense at all, but it was their way of explaining why they had done what. Let me give you an example. I once had a young man, had everything going for him, and I remember him very well because he was tall, he was good looking, he was athletic, he just got married, he had a really cute wife, he had a good job. He was going to school in the evening part-time. He was ambitious. He came from a good family. And he had just confessed a felony that was going to put him in prison. And his explanation for the theft of a very large amount of lumber came down to this. Well, my wife's pregnant. We're going to have a baby. I don't have enough funds with schooling and everything really to do up a room for. So I took this lumber in order to finish a room in the basement so she would have her own nursery. Now, okay, in a sense, your heart goes out. You understand the man is driven to...
It reminds me of Carousel. And that song, My Boy Bill, and he's going to do anything. He's going to rob someone. He's going to do anything to, get money to take care of his son and his daughter.
Right, right. And, you know, and the bottom line is, okay, in a very narrow sense, I understand that motive. But in the larger perspective, it makes no sense whatsoever to destroy the lives of so many people involved because of what? The notion that I had to do or be something in order to be accepted as this person, as this man, as this husband that I'm supposed to be? It undercuts everything. My fascination for why people do what they do is what led the path of my life. I never gave it up. As a practicing criminalist, conducting lie detection examinations, I became, fascinated, intrigued by what we called inconclusives. The number of people that would come in who brought situational stress with them, they were just terrified you were going to call them deceptive. And so it skewed their charts in such a way you couldn't say they were practicing deception or not. And that hardened dude with his countermeasures that you could see, you could try and stop, but it didn't change the chart. And so you had to rely on the chart to make your call. And it was still inconclusive, even though you knew the individual was lying to you in your heart of hearts. You didn't have the objective evidence to support that. So I got very interested in how you might minimize these inconclusives. And I'd heard that the Los Angeles Police Department had conducted a study in preparation for the LA Olympics. And when I heard about this, I attempted to confirm or have it denied, and to this day, I've never been able to get anybody to step forward and say, yeah, we did it, or no, we didn't. But the bottom line was they use subliminal messages to dehydrate cadets in the academy to see if this would work if they were dealing with negotiators over the telephone. Well, that sent my career in a bit of a veer, because then I became really interested in this stuff we call self-talk, this stuff that William James labeled as a stream of consciousness. And I was quick to learn that it is that stream of consciousness that is what predisposes us to everything that we do in our lives. You know, you're a professional. You know about Ben Libet's work back in the 50s when he looked for a cortical evoked potential, the supposed P300 wave, and discovered that it occurred in areas or regions of the brain that are unconscious before any conscious action. And that caused this major, you know, conversation in universities around the world about free will. Well, if the subconscious is giving us what we're thinking, then we must not have free will. Well, you know, today we know that using functional magnetic resonance imaging, a technician watching your brain make a decision, giving you a complex kind of a problem. You have a button in your right hand, a button in your left hand. You can choose, you know, between the two alternatives by simply pushing the appropriate button. That technician will know what you're going to decide on average 6 seconds before you know. So we know for a fact that it is the subconscious that is doing the thinking. It is the conscious then that is rationalizing the explanation, justifying why you do what you do or why you chose what you chose. Let me give you an example. We take five automobiles, new cars, different colors, different makes, and over one drape a beautiful woman scantily clad, a bikini. And we ask men to rate the car, which is the fastest. They'll invariably rate the one with the woman draped over it. Think about the basic drives. There's an arousal attachment. That's the reason they do that, okay? Now we bring them back a week later. We have the same five cars. They are different colors, and our bikini-clad maiden is on a different car. They will rate the different car, the one with the woman in the bikini, as the fastest. And when you point out to them that their choice is really not about the car, it's about this bikini, it's about this arousal, they'll deny that. And they'll begin to justify why they chose this car this time over the car they had chosen the last time. And you know, they may come up with, well, I didn't see the baffle on the hood, or, well, you know. But it's all rationalization. Our subconscious, our stream of consciousness, which is a mirror on our subconscious, is actually making our decisions. So what I did was create an interdiction, a program. It's not truly subliminal. It's something we call dichotic masking, but the public thinks of it as subliminal. And we delivered that in our lie detection scenario, and our inconclusives disappeared. Other lie detection examiners wanted to copy it, and they did, and we were going along fine until the AG informed us, state AG, that it probably wasn't a good idea without informed consent. But a friend of mine at the Utah State Prison, who was aware of what I was doing, asked me if we might not use that at the prison to lower hostility and aggression, increase reflectivity, maybe even interrupt the recidivity rate. So we went out to the Utah State Prison. We ran some very extensive psychometrics first, including the MMPI through the Fowler lens. You would know about Dr. Goodstone. But, you know, a major tool, psychometric tool, designed specifically for an inmate population, incarcerated population. But we didn't get anything new out of that. I mean, we had high scores in self and social alienation, but you knew that going in. So when I sat and visited with these people, these were young men in the youth offenders facility, 25 and under, supposedly first-time offenders, but it's rare that a first-time offender really goes to the big school prison. But at any rate, as we, as I sat and visited with him, I heard the same rationalizations and justifications coming out. You know, I heard stories like, Abba, for the grace of God, there go you. You know, my daddy was an alcoholic, my mommy was a prostitute. Crazy stories, almost always exaggerated. But even if they weren't exaggerated, you could have two brothers come from the same home, the same set of circumstances, the same genes. One would be a physician in a teaching hospital. The other one in maximum security for some heinous act, okay? So it was clear that the conscious mind was doing this justification, this rationalization. So we did an interdiction using this dichotically masked technology you mentioned at the top of the show called InterTalk. And what we did was we went at undoing their ability to blame. Because until you take, you know, self-responsibility for everything in your life, you're disempowered. To the very extent that you consider yourself to be a victim, that's the extent to which you externalize your blame. And as long as you're a victim, you're frozen in that place, in that time. You cannot move beyond that. It has tethered you just as surely as if you have been tied and bound in place. And, you know, there's two ways to be bound. Someone can tie me up, you know, they can chain me like an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can attach a thread to a doorknob and refuse to let go of it or pull it hard enough to break it. And that's what we often do with beliefs that are self-destructive. We refuse to let go of them. We hang on to them, and we're just as surely tied up. So we created programs that were designed to increase reflectivity and undo this blame game. And that became known as the forgiveness set. I forgive myself. I forgive all others. I am forgiven. And once that happened, you have nobody to blame. And once you have nobody to blame, well, now you're empowered. You're empowered to change your life. You're moving on. You're making lemonade, if you will, out of lemons, because bad things do happen to good people. But you have... You are proactive about it all. Well, it works so well in the prison system that they install voluntary libraries throughout. It was cloned into other prison systems. It did absolutely change the way people talk to themselves, which changed their expectation, which changes their perception. And the science is hard there. We know that if you expect... the world is hostile and nasty.
Oh, yeah.
That you will go into the world with that expectation. You do a lot of family marriage counseling. You know that when a couple expect the worst from each other, that the ability to negotiate with those people has to begin by changing their expectation of one another. So what we had simply done was change the way they talk to themselves. And that, of course, changed my career, and voila, that's where I am today.
Wow. What a story and what a background you have. This is very different from most people who talk about positive thinking.
You've really delved into it. I think I'm very... I mean, I don't mean this in some self-aggrandizement way, but I think I'm very fortunate and blessed to have come from a hardcore view. I mean, I can remember when Lee Liston, who today is the warden at the female facility in Utah, when Lee, my friend at the prison, said, you know, could we maybe use this to rehabilitate some of the inmates? My attitude about that was custodial. Are you kidding? I mean, these guys are just going to come out, they're going to live next door to you, they're going to date your daughter, and they're going to continue being the bad folks they are. You know, I had a very negative kind of view that way. So when I could see that you actually can change these things with just a few basic, simple adjustments in your life, and they begin by your expectation, which is fed by how you talk to yourself, it was to me not just a change in my career, but a change in my own life. Because you might say I was a very jaded kind of a person. I would say I was very jaded at that point in my life. I suddenly became very optimistic about people and their potential. And indeed, you know, because this is a boomer program, you know, I'm 72 years old. I've got my youngest son is a senior in high school this year. He's a 4.0 student. He's going to head out for college. He wants to maybe think about going into law enforcement. He'd like to maybe be a member of the BAU for the Bureau. Of course, he watches too many TV programs. Perhaps that's why, but I don't know. At any rate, I said to him, okay, look, if you really want to do that, let me just go license as a private investigator, and we'll run a case or two, you and I. And my wife looked over at me, and she said, yeah, why not? I mean, you're as fit as most guys 50. Why not? You know, I have truly learned that this whole aging process, this whole living process, is all a matter of our expectation. When we are children, we're tiny, and we first come into the world, we explore everything. You know that, Dr. Goodstone. I mean, listen, we might even reach into our diaper and pull out one of those little brown things to see what it tastes like. We don't know inhibition. We haven't been pulled off to the side. No, little Johnny, you should never show emotion like that. Getting angry is just horrible, you know. Anger is something that you just want to get rid of anger, little Johnny. So what does little Johnny do with his anger? Well, he represses it. I mean, it's a natural emotion, and instead of being helped in how you can benefit from understanding that emotion and use it in a positive way, he's taught to deny it, push it aside, hide it. And all of these emotions that we think are just horrible and negative, well, we're taught to hide them. You know, Robert Bly's wonderful little book, you know, A Little Book on the Human Shadow, talks about a long bag where we just take all these emotions, all these feelings, and we just shove them in this long bag, but we drag it along with us because we're repressing it. And then one day, you know, it hasn't been a great day, and somebody maybe cut us off in traffic, and we get home, and for no reason, we dump on a loved one, our wife, our children. And then, you know, afterwards, why did I do that? What's wrong with me? See, we don't understand that who we are, again, coming back to your little book, Be Who You Are, includes all these emotions. All these things you have been taught not to do. Now, it doesn't mean, okay, go out there and act like some raging fool. But what it does mean is, you know, we can just do little shifts of context and everything changes. I'm in 5 o'clock traffic. I'm in a hurry to get home. I've got tickets to the theater. It's a show I really want to see. I've got really expensive seats. I was in the office longer than I wanted. I could be late. My wife's waiting for me. She's all dressed and pacing. And as I'm moving on the freeway, somebody cuts in front of me, forces me to jam my brakes on, and speeds along the road, you know? The natural reaction from almost everybody is to become angry. And so you flip the person off, you blare your horn, you allow all the cortisol to fill up your neurochemicals, you know, charging in, and the adrenaline rushes on, and you're in fight flight. And what you just did was minimize the optimal operation of your endocrine, your immune, and your autonomic nervous system. Well, okay, if you want to die young, be sick a lot, you know, that's a great way to live. But if your objective is to live a life that is a valid, vital, enjoyable life, that's the wrong way to live. So what do? I make a simple context shift. That happens to me. In my mind, I think, maybe they have a small child in the back laying on the seat. They're bleeding and they're trying to get to the hospital. I'm gladly give you the space in front of me. Be well. Be blessed. You know, I hope everything's going to be okay. In other words, I've changed the context just a little bit. And now that emotion that I have has got a positive outlet. It's no longer rage and discontent, you see. And so
what a beautiful story. I wanted to ask you something. You know, how do other people control our thoughts? And you really gave a great example of that. The other person didn't even know they're controlling our thoughts, but we're getting all angry and upset. So how does that happen, that we let others do that?
Well, it's as simple as I become mindful. The first thing I do is I recognize every thought, emotion that I have. And I do that without judgment. You know, in comes a thought, we call them aberrant thoughts, okay? In comes this aberrant thought. And I go, that's not me. I don't want to think that. And we, again, put it in our long bag. Instead, what we should be doing is, well, that's interesting. Wonder why I would have that thought. Have I ever thought that before? When was the first time I thought that? What would seed that thought? Is that something I want? Is that a behavior that I choose? You know, when I went to university, I was taught IQ was fixed. Brain cells begin to die in your 30s and they don't replenish themselves. Mm-hmm. Personality is fixed. Well, that's all nonsense. That's just false to fact stuff. And we know that now, you know. The bottom line is neuroplasticity shows us You not only can change how your brain is wired, you can literally increase the amount of gray matter. So don't give me this cells die. And we also know that one of the best ways to enjoy a more fruitful life is to change your personality. You want to improve your life, change your personality. You do that by perhaps becoming mindful, making a reconnoiter. What personality characteristics would I like to be more loving? Would I like to be more passionate? Would I like to be more capable of listening better? And so on and so forth. What we do is we become mindful, and as we become mindful, we begin to change context. Just as everybody wants to make $1 million. I've asked that question, I don't know how many hundreds of times, to thousands of people, and they all raise their hand. So I say, okay, in order for you to make $1 million this year, I said make, not win, you know that you're going to have to go at risk. You're going to have to do something different. You may have to mortgage your home. You may have to get partners. You may have to borrow money, whatever. You're going to maybe even have to quit your job to do it. So I want you to say to yourself now, because in order for that to happen, you're going to have to believe, really believe, you can make $1 million. Say to yourself, mm-hmm. Your audience can do it. This year I'm going to earn $1 million. And see how long it takes before you start hearing talk back. Sure, what are you going to do, rob a bank? That little conscious entry will begin to mitigate your best affirmations by giving you a reflection of what you truly believe. You truly don't believe you deserve it. Well, if you want to be successful, the next time you pull up on the back of somebody that's driving that new Ferrari that you just have always wanted in the perfect color, you don't say to yourself or think, I wonder what they did. That's probably one of those Wall Street bankers. They're probably thieves, you know. Instead, you see that and you say, wow, good for you. That's for me. Because now in changing that context, you just made it possible. You didn't push it away. You didn't define it as evil. You attract it to yourself. Well, yeah, I like that. That's mine. See, context is everything when we come to perception. Think of it this way. I love this. This is my favorite analogy. Think of the saliva in your mouth, Dr. Goodstone. I think of mine right now. And if I'm going to rate it 1 to 10, I'm going to give it a 9-10 because without it, I can't have this conversation with you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you rate your own. Your listening audience, you know, rate yours as well. Now, I just want you to imagine that you've got a little shot glass, and it's in front of you, and you're going to deposit some of that saliva in the shot glass. Imagine that you're depositing the saliva. Don't spit into it, actually, okay? Tip it a little bit. All right, now drink it back. Knock it on back. Now, when you do this with a live audience, you'll get, oh, ooh, ah. And the reason is this. The saliva in my mouth may be marvelous, but the idea of drinking spit in a glass is vile. All I've done is change the context slightly. This tiny little context. Become aware of how often your expectation sees the world in a lens that defines the outcome. Take, for example, Susan Boyle. Remember, UK's Got Talent, Susan Boyle steps out on the stage. Circa 1950s dress, a housekeeping dress for that matter, not even a formal dress, like she was in the kitchen cooking brownies or something. Disheveled a bit. Hair, remember teasing hair? She had quite a hairdo. So now the crowd looking at her they're not oohing and aahing. They're jeering and laughing and rolling their eyes. And you look at the judges and they're doing the same thing. Their body language totally closes down and they're shaking their heads. And then she opens her mouth and begins to sing and the most mellifluous sound comes out. You have to ask yourself, what makes you think a singer needs to look a certain way? See, we go into life with all these frames that define our experience. When we begin to become mindful, we begin to change the frames. We begin to change the context. We become proactive about that. And then we have the power to seed a new stream of consciousness. A new set of expectations arise, and that changes our perception of the world, and that changes the world.
Wow. So I was going to ask, you seem to answer the question before I ask that, like how can we find self-peace and how does this help the world? So maybe explain a little more, but you really did just explain it.
Well, Dr. Goodstone, I developed what I consider to be a four-corner philosophy. The first corner of that philosophy is the forgiveness, undo the blame. The second corner is take responsibility for everything in your life. Let me give you a quick example there, because I define self-responsibility maybe a little different than most people. I'm not talking about Emerson's essay on self-responsibility. I'm going to go further than that. When I moved my offices years ago over to Las Vegas, Nevada, I visited the post office the first day, and it was hot, and the air conditioning wasn't working, and the patrons were nasty to each other and the postal clerks, and the postal clerks themselves were nasty to the patrons. It was a horrible experience, mm-hmm. and I had come from a post office that I visited every day to pick up mail that, people were warm and charming and we all knew one another and, I knew the postal people and called them by name and they spoke to me. And so this was a very bad experience. Now, I could have opted to send my secretary every day to the post office because I just simply wasn't going to, deal with that. But instead, I chose to do what I could do to improve that situation. So the next day when I went to the post office, I put a big smile on my face. Hi, how are you? Hey, did you hear about UNLV's basketball team? And I did my best to be warm and gregarious and outgoing and smile. Start everyone smiling. And initially, I have to tell you, I got the weirdest, queerest looks from some people, and some were just outright rude about it. What's wrong with you? But I kept it up for 30 days. And I'm going to tell you, that was my test period. I'm going to do this for 30 days. I don't know. Maybe I would have sent my secretary if it hadn't worked. But it did work. By the end of 30 days, when I arrived at the post office, hi, Doc, how you doing? Everything had changed. People were warmer, they smiled, they talked. There were still long lines, but we chatted across lines and to one another in the lines. It was an entirely different experience. the patrons as well as the postal clerks had completely changed because one person decided this is unacceptable. This isn't the way human beings should act. Now, that, in my view, is taking responsibility. The next thing we need to do in life is recognize the power of gratitude. I'll give your listening audience a magic message right now. You want to change your life beginning tomorrow, I'm going to give you a couple of easy things to begin doing right now that will absolutely change your life. When you first wake in the morning, put a smile on your face. A big smile. I don't care if you have to fake that smile because you just had a terrible dream. Put a big smile on your face. The brain doesn't know that those facial muscles are being forced into the smile. Put the smile on your face and the brain releases endorphins, the body's, you know, natural opiate system. And guess what? I begin to feel better immediately. Say to yourself, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I don't care what you're saying thank you for. Just say thank you, thank you, thank you. We now have over 24 studies that clearly show that the simple power of gratitude, that act of thank you, is sufficient to increase your life expectancy, your quality of life, including your health or wellness, well-being. So, two things. Now, I'm going to add a third thing, but I have to go to the fourth corner of my four-corner philosophy for that. And that fourth corner is service. I once had a client referred to me by a psychiatrist, actually, who was suicidal and had made many attempts, and she, you know, long story short, she felt that she was not worthy of living, so cutting herself was something she deserved. When I looked at her intake sheets, I saw that her first therapist was none other than Milton Erickson. And I honestly thought to myself, if Milton Erickson, I mean, who walks on water in my mind, couldn't help her, I don't know what I'm going to do. So when she came in, you know, sometimes you just get lucky, or maybe it's serendipity, I'm not sure. Maybe the universe inspires us. But when she came in, I changed up and did something I've never done before. I told her I'd see her for 10 sessions in something called brief therapy. You know all about that, I know. And she could call me if she had an emergency or something during the week, but it would be once a week for 1 hour, and she had homework. And if she didn't do the homework, I wasn't going to see her. So I explained it to her, and she agreed to it. Now, here's her homework. Every day that first week, she had to go out of her way to do a good deed for someone. Every day. Didn't care what the good deed was, but she had to go out of her way to help another human being. At the end of the day, she was to take a clean new journal. I don't care what it was made of. It could be toilet paper. You didn't have to go to the store and buy something. But clean sheets of paper and write what her good deed was for the day. And then write how she thinks it made that person feel. And then write how it made her feel. Three simple things. Journal at the first week. Week two, it was 2 good deeds. We got up to 5 good deeds. And she didn't always do 5. And in that first week, some of her good deeds were lame, to say the least. But it started a new process in her. And by the end of the 10 weeks, she was off a lot of her medication. I followed her. She was a changed person. Within a very short period, she was off of all medication, and within a year, she was released from the care she was under with a psychiatrist. The bottom line is this: what she learned is the most important thing any of us can learn in life. Our self-esteem doesn't come from diplomas and awards and automobiles or swimming pools. It doesn't come from the clothes we wear. It comes from who we help. It comes from knowing that our life made a difference. when you put your head on the pillow at night and you have that warm, fuzzy feeling that comes from, I helped someone today. My life made a difference to them. I was able to make it easier for them. That only comes from going to the aid of another human being. We are hardwired in such a way that simply writing a check to a charity that we really care about releases neurochemicals that optimize our system. We know that objectively. We watch it with fMRI. The bottom line is we are wired in ways that reward us for aiding another human being. I don't know how you can be, as you say, who you are without recognizing the hardwiring. You're hardwired in ways that most of us have been taught to ignore or to push away, or, well, that's for someone else, or I can't afford to give, or, you know, you give first at home. The bottom line is service. So I would suggest, as a third thing, to really change that life of yours, is get yourself a little journal. And beginning today, do one good deed to help one person. Go out of your way. You know, I mean, you see someone at the cash stand, they're short a few pennies, to hand them the money. Somebody is in a hurry, slow down, flash your lights, let them pull in, let them change that lane in front of you. It doesn't call for great big actions to begin to think, how can I help someone? Now, I'll tell you a true story. I came off a radio program where I told this story about service last week. And my son was sitting waiting for me to finish because we were going to then go into town. And as soon as I got off, he said to me, "Do you really do that, Dad?" I said, "Of course I do. I see you sometimes let people in, lane changes and things, but how far out of your way would you go?" "I don't know. I mean, you know." And I told him a story about once going to, well, and that's another story, but it was a story of helping somebody in a situation where there was some danger involved, but it doesn't matter to that. To that end, we got in the truck, my truck, and we started into town. And as I pulled up to a semaphore on an orange light, just changing to red, I saw a guy goose through it ahead of me in the other lane, and another pickup truck and a brand new tire popped out of that truck of his, bounced across the road, and laid down near a bus stop. And I saw him just wailing on down the road. This is a 55 mile an hour speed zone. So as soon as the light changed, I finally was able to work my way through traffic to overtake him a few miles down the road, honk and wave. His wife rolled down the window. They pulled over. I told them where their tire was. They turned around, went back, and got the tire. Now, that evening, when I put my head on the pillow, the only good deed I'd really been able to do was help that person go get his tire. That's not a big deal. But it was enough for me to say it was a good day. And that's what we all want to do when we put our head on the pillow at night. It was a good day. Does that make
Dr.
sense
Taylor,
to you?
This is just so beautiful what you've shared. And anyone who follows these simple steps can really transform their life. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I am so grateful to you for being on this program today.
It's indeed been my pleasure, and I thank you for the opportunity to share, and I wish you good luck with everything you're doing. I love what you do.
Thank you. And your book, tell us the name of your book so people can get it.
Well, you know, most of everything we've talked about today comes from the book Choices and Illusions. It is a New York Times bestseller, and I really, that's where the starting place for me is. You can get it at any brick-and-mortar bookstore. You can get it online. It's on sale at Amazon and Barnes & Noble right now. You can go to my website to learn more about what I do and more about the InterTalk technology. That's Eldon, E-L-D-O-N, EldonTaylor.com. And thank you again, Dr. Goodstone, for this opportunity.
You are most welcome. And to those of you listening, I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Please check out my upcoming
Men and Love Summit, which is at menandlove.org. It's all about men and how they love. And Dr. Eldon Taylor has added such an important piece to this for all of us. Bye for now.